DW Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
Today on the show, the International Arms Trade Treaty is now set to come into force.
No one's saying that the treaty is a panacea, but if it's effectively and robustly implemented, it will be a giant leap forward. It's about making a real difference to people's lives by stopping arms going where they're used for atrocities.
Vienna is opening its arms to new faiths, and why plans for a new U.S. naval base in the Philippines are not making everyone happy.
Even if there's a lot of jobs, there's a lot of facilities will be put up there. But if you will cut the mangrove area, it will greatly affect also their livelihood.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Raspa in Bonn. This is a busy week at the UN in New York. Apart from the climate conference and the General Assembly, other issues are also on the agenda, including the International Arms Trade Treaty. It's expected that several more countries will ratify the treaty this week, which will bring the number of ratifying countries up to 50. And that means that the Arms Trade Treaty can finally come into force at the end of December. The treaty is the first one ever aimed at regulating the global trade in weapons, particularly to countries who use them to commit genocide, crimes against humanity, or other serious human rights violations. It's estimated that every year more than 500,000 people die and millions more are injured, raped, or forced to flee their homes as a result of the global trade in weapons. But not all countries are willing to sign an agreement. For more than two decades, Amnesty International and other groups have campaigned for an arms trade treaty, or AAT. Rasha Abdul-Rahim is a campaigner on arms control, security trade and human rights at Amnesty International. I asked her why this arms trade treaty is so important.
The Arms Trade Treaty is something that Amnesty has actually been involved in right from the beginning. So Amnesty International's head of arms control and human rights was actually one of the four people in the room when the idea for an arms trade treaty was conceived. And it was conceived by a small group of NGOs back in 1993. And, you know, from then onwards, Amnesty and its partners have been campaigning to achieve a strong, legally binding set of rules to stop the flow of conventional arms and munitions that can fuel serious human rights abuses.
What exactly does this trade treaty now regulate, and who will control whether arms trading will happen according to this treaty?
The treaty regulates a series of conventional weapons that includes things like small arms and light weapons, ammunition, explosives, bombs, missiles, tanks, military vehicles, military aircraft, naval ships, etc. And under the terms of the treaty, the onus is on the governments to control these weapons and to assess the risk that transferring the arms, the ammunition, or the components to another country could be used for serious human rights violations or violations of international humanitarian law. So the treaty asks states to establish and maintain effective national control systems to control the export, the import, the transit of arms. And states are also asked to maintain a national control list, which they share with other states that are party to the treaty. And the other part of the treaty, states are actually obliged to report annually on their arms exports. Now, for Amnesty International, the most important provision of the treaty is the one to do with human rights. So there's a prohibition that states are not allowed to transfer arms if they will be used for serious crimes like war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, etc. Now, the second part is more of a risk assessment. So states have to conduct a risk assessment to assess whether there's a substantial risk that the arms that they're transferring to another country could be used for serious human rights abuses.
You just said that governments are supposed to ensure that arms get into the hands of the right people and not people who will commit human rights violations with these arms.
Yep.
But for instance, when we look at the current situation in Iraq, where there's talk about giving Kurdish fighters weapons, how can it be ensured that such arms are not used to commit human rights violations?
Well, actually, Amnesty International is calling for a more preventive approach and strict safeguards. to mitigate and remove the substantial risk of the arms being used. So before any transfers of military equipment are authorized, we're asking governments to take concrete, enforceable, transparent and verifiable mechanisms to make sure that the military equipment supplied isn't likely to be misused or diverted and then misused, really to try and protect the people on the ground and to prevent serious human rights violations from occurring.
Now, that sounds very theoretical because given that a lot of countries have not signed and will certainly not ratify this agreement, like, for instance, Syria, will not arms and equipment continue to be sold to these countries, whether it's legally or illegally?
Yeah, well, to tackle the illicit trade, you need to first control the legal and legitimate trade. So most of the weapons that end up in the illegal trade start in the authorized trade. So to reduce the risk of diversion to unauthorized users, for example, and to minimize the risk of loopholes and weaknesses being exploited by unscrupulous arms dealers, we need a global treaty like an arms trade treaty with strong human rights protection, and we need that treaty to be effectively implemented.
So what difference will it make for people on the ground who are now victims of a conflict that this arms trade treaty will now come into effect in December?
Well, if the treaty is implemented effectively, it could help stop irresponsible arms flows from fueling serious violations that we're seeing in places like Syria and Iraq, as you mentioned. It's about making a real difference to people's lives by stopping arms going where they're used for atrocities. Now, no one's saying that the treaty is the panacea, but if it's effectively and robustly implemented, it will be, you know, a giant leap forward in making sure there's greater protection for the hundreds of millions of people whose lives and livelihoods are affected by this. Now, of course, we want more states to ratify and effectively implement the ATT, but there's already real international momentum building behind this. Now, it's important that, obviously, the world's largest arms exporting countries are part of the treaty, but it's also important to stress that well over half of all states have already signed the ATT and over a quarter have ratified in little over a year, which is really a fast pace for such a global treaty. So if civil society keep pushing, then the most skeptical states will join the treaty eventually. And, you know, just to remind you also that 5 of the top 10 arms exporting states have already ratified the treaty.
Including Germany.
Exactly, including the UK, Germany, France, Italy and Spain. And, you know, just to give you another example about the US, we're often asked, you know, well, the US will never ratify, which, you know, may be the case because there's a huge pro-gun lobby inside of the US. But, for example, in January 2014, the US issued a new policy directive on conventional arms sales, and that was the first one since the mid-90s. And basically, the directive pledges not to export arms where there's a likelihood that the weapons transferred will be used for genocide or other atrocities or will violate human rights law or international humanitarian law. So, you know, this is a positive development and an indication that the US could ratify in the future. And if you look at, for example, the Mine Ban Convention, otherwise called the Ottawa Treaty, that came into force in 1999 and the US had not signed it. But in June 2014, the Obama administration announced that the US would no longer produce anti-personnel landmines or acquire new ones. And the administration also said that it was diligently pursuing other policies that would allow the US to agree to the landmine treaty. So this is more than 15 years after the treaty came into force. And just yesterday, the US pledged to destroy existing stockpiles of anti-personnel landmines outside the Korean Peninsula. So basically, the arms trade treaty will have an effect, even if it takes a long time.
That was Amnesty International's Rasha Abdulrahim talking about the International Arms Trade Treaty. For our next report, we're moving to a place with saber-rattling of a different kind. The Philippines and China are locked in a territorial dispute in the South China Sea. The region is interesting for several reasons. It's not only rich in fish, there's also a lot of international shipping traffic. And beneath the surface of the sea, many believe there are huge unexplored oil and gas reserves. In recent years, Beijing has set forces to occupy reefs that were claimed by Manila. The island of Palawan in the West Philippines is at the forefront of these tensions. Now Manila is considering permitting the United States to base some of its own forces there in order to boost its claims. While many local people would welcome the Americans because they hope for an economic boost for the community, not everyone is so keen on a U.S. naval base on their doorstep. Jason Strother has more.
Down on the docks in the small fishing village of Makarascas on Palawan's west coast, locals are taking their boats out to sea. It's a sunny, clear day, perfect conditions to bring back a catch of mackerel or some octopuses, the fishermen hope. Jane Villarin is the 37-year-old leader of the local community council.
Our population as of now is almost 1,700, and our main source of income was fishing and farming.
The fishermen in her village share the waterways with the Filipino Navy.
On the left side, there's another small bay, and then that's the Oyster Bay area.
And so right now, Oyster Bay, there's nothing there in Oyster Bay, right?
No, just the naval boats, yeah, and the naval port.
Just across the waterfront is the Ulugan Bay Navy Base, home to just a small fleet of patrol boats and military personnel. About 160 kilometers west of here are the Spratly Islands, an archipelago of hundreds of rocks, reefs, and islets. Several countries in this region lay claim to this area, principally the Philippines and China. It's an area rich in marine life and thought to have vast untapped natural resources. About 50% of the world's maritime traffic sails through these waters. Over the past few years, navies from both countries have been confronting each other at sea. Villarin says it's a bit scary to live in effectively what has become the front row seat of what some in the region are starting to call a flashpoint. That's why she's pleased to have the Navy nearby.
Protection for us. We live here in the West Philippine Sea, so that's our fear. So that's why we are, that's why the Naval and the Philippine Navy are welcome here because of that.
And she adds she'd welcome the American Navy here too.
Today I'm pleased that we're beginning an important new chapter in the relationship between our countries, and it starts with our security, with the new defense cooperation agreement that was signed today.
In April, U.S. President Barack Obama and Philippines leader Benigno Aquino signed a new defense pact, the Enhancement of Defense Cooperation Agreement, or EDCA, which opens the door for American forces to be stationed in the Philippines 22 years after the U.S. closed its bases here. But as Obama explained, it's more of a base-sharing arrangement than a reestablishment of American power in the region.
I want to be very clear. The United States is not trying to reclaim old bases or build new bases. At the invitation of the Philippines, American service members will rotate through Filipino facilities.
A Makarascas fisherman takes me out on his boat as close as we can get to the Ulugan Bay base. Inside here is another, deeper port called Oyster Bay. The Philippines government is offering this underdeveloped facility for use by the U.S. Navy. Lieutenant Colonel Ramon Zagala is chief of the Public Affairs Office for the Armed Forces of the Philippines.
The very purpose of that base is to enhance our defense capabilities westward towards the West Philippine Sea. Oyster Bay is one of those that we want to offer to the United States so that we can further develop it.
He says it's still too early to determine how big or what might be included in the proposed base-sharing agreement. Community leader Jane Villarin sees an opportunity for her village, too. Most people in Makarascas earn just over $100 a month. She says inviting Americans here will bring more jobs to the barangay, as the community is called in the local language.
Yeah, it's a sign of development in our barangay. Maybe more business to come. Progress in our barangay.
The majority of people here in bustling Puerto Princesa feel the same way as Ms. Villarin. They see the expansion of the Oyster Bay base as a potential boost for the economy. But not everyone here is happy about having a modern American fleet with bigger ships and soldiers in their backyard. Environmentalists point out that much of Palawan Island is a protected conservation zone, including the mangrove forest around the Navy base.
I'm Elizabeth Maclang, the current park superintendent of the Puerto Princesa Subterranean River National Park.
She says Puerto Princesa, to which Oyster Bay and the Makarascas village belong, opposes the military's plan to develop the base and allow Americans to use it on environmental grounds. McClung says local communities don't realize what's at stake, like chopping down the mangroves in order to build a new port and other installations.
Even if there's a lot of jobs, there's a lot of facilities will be put up there. But if you will cut the mangroves, the mangrove area, it will greatly affect also their livelihood, because the Makaraskas and Bahili is one of the potential ecotourism sites also, and that would add some livelihood also for them.
McClung explains that the U.S. doesn't have a good environmental track record in the Philippines as it is. In 1992, American forces left the Philippines after almost a century of deployment here, but the bases that were handed back over were left heavily polluted. And last year, a U.S. Navy ship crashed into one of Palawan's coral reef preserves. Environmental advocates say the U.S. pretty much got off with just a slap on the wrist from the national government. The stationing of American forces on Palawan could also bring some other unwanted impacts to the community. There's a strip of bars in Puerto Princesa that cater to male patrons. About 20 girls work in this particular establishment, all have been brought in from outside of Palawan, the manager, Ms. Tess, tells me. She says American soldiers who are in the Philippines off duty are some of her best customers, and she'd be happy to have more.
Yeah, during the past year, yeah, they are customers. I think that is, they are not here for work that time. I think that is their rest and recreation.
The prospect of expanding the Oyster Bay base and stationing Americans there alarms Gina Enriquez, the director of the Coalition Against Trafficking in the Asia Pacific, based in Manila.
The presence of naval soldiers in that area would also mean that existence of a demand side to trafficking and also prostitution, and that could be a magnet for the trafficking of women and children from the outskirts of Oyster Bay, probably from Puerto Princesa, and very vulnerable communities, indigenous communities around Palawan who are very poor.
Enriquez points out that in the areas where American bases used to be, prostitution and human trafficking are still serious problems. She and other advocates have taken their concerns to the streets and have protested against the redeployment of U.S. soldiers to the Philippines.
No to U.S. bases!
No to U.S. bases!
No to imperialist wars and intervention!
No to intervention!
These demonstrators greeted President Obama during his trip to Manila earlier this year. And it seems that their worries are being heard by the nation's top court. Judges are now reviewing petitions that claim the new U.S.-Philippines Defense Pact, EDCA, is unconstitutional. The Armed Forces' Ramon Zagala says plans for the Oyster Bay-based development have been put on hold for now, but he doesn't expect for long.
But out of due respect to the Supreme Court, we would rather wait on what their actions would be on those petitions before we start anything. We respect the Supreme Court, and we know that the negotiations of the EDCA made by the Department of National Defense and the United States also is above board and will pass scrutiny.
Zagala says more talks between the U.S. and the Philippines are needed before any decisions can be made about the Oyster Bay base.
Ma'am, ay, Rek, magalis na raw, wala pa.
Back in Makaraskas, despite the protests, community leader Jane Villarin says her barangay hopes that the plan will go through soon. In the meantime, she says locals are already getting familiar with American soldiers.
Oh, the U.S. Navy, oh, they came here last year and have some projects in our elementary school, in our barangay.
And that, she says, makes the Americans even more welcome for most residents here. For DW, I'm Jason Strother in Palawan, the Philippines.
Still to come here on World in Progress, a report about the changing faiths of the Austrian capital Vienna, which is becoming an increasingly multi-religious city. But first, Emma Wallace takes a look at some development news.
UN Climate Fund still far short of goal. The new Green Climate Fund has received pledges of $2.3 billion, including $1 billion each annually from Germany and France. Switzerland, South Korea, Denmark, Norway, and Mexico have also pledged contributions. However, the figure remains far below the goal. The Green Climate Fund, which aims to help poor nations worst hit by rising temperatures and disasters, aims to raise $10 billion by the end of the year in order to start operations, with the total rising to $100 billion annually by 2020. Cambodia and Australia set to sign controversial refugee deal. Cambodia said on Wednesday it would sign an agreement to resettle Australia-bound refugees on its soil, despite opposition from rights groups to the rerouting of asylum seekers to one of Southeast Asia's poorest nations. Under its hardline immigration policy, Australia already sends asylum seekers arriving by boat to camps in Papua New Guinea and the remote Pacific state of Nauru for processing and resettlement. Cambodia is one of the poorest countries in Southeast Asia, with around 20% of the population, or 2.8 million people, living in poverty. Rights groups say it is ill-equipped to handle any intake of refugees, especially since its weak justice system and reputation for rights violations could leave newcomers prone to abuse. Uyghur sentenced to life urges peace from Chinese prison. Iham Toti, a prominent Uyghur academic sentenced to life in prison, has called for peace, his lawyer said. Western powers have criticised the sentence and are calling for a release of Toti. They accuse Beijing of silencing a moderate voice on charges of separatism. It's feared that the sentencing of Toti, who advocated for the rights of the 10 million mostly Muslim Uyghur minority in China, could inflame tensions in the rest of Xinjiang region. Peace is a gift from the heavens to Uyghurs and Han, Toti said from prison. More protests against planned Nicaragua canal. Hundreds of farmers in southern Nicaragua demonstrated on Tuesday against a new $50 billion US dollar waterway aimed at rivaling the Panama Canal. They are angry at plans to expropriate the land they work. It was the second protest against the mega project within a week. For their part, the managing commission said it would pay fair prices to landowners whose property is taken for building the canal. Work on the 278-kilometre waterway is scheduled to begin later this year.
That was Emma Wallace with the development news. The Austrian capital, Vienna, was once a place that could be described as mainly Catholic or even overwhelmingly Catholic, but not anymore. New studies show a city with a rapidly changing religious and ethnic structure. With almost a third of its population foreign-born, Catholicism is on the wane. Carrie Skyring reports on Vienna's rapidly changing religious landscape and how the city is dealing with its new identity.
The bells of St. Stephen's. The sound is synonymous with the city, just like the cathedral in which the bells hang. It's a big draw for the tourists who flock here for the tour of its catacombs and to climb its towers. But for the citizens of the Austrian capital, this church and the hundreds of others which dominate its landscape is increasingly irrelevant. Still a draw for the tourists, but no longer a big draw for the majority, because in Vienna, Catholics are rapidly becoming the minority.
So, but okay, if we start with the global flow of people, that's a new way of visualizing it.
Ramon Bauer, crunching the numbers at the Vienna Institute of Demography. With a mouse click, he can illustrate the world's changing religious and demographic landscape. And Ramon's own city, Vienna, is a striking example of this revolution in religion, brought about by migration, changing fertility, and religious beliefs. In 1970, more than 80% of Viennese said they were Catholic. Now fewer than half say that.
It's mainly, I would say, social change towards a postmodern society on the one hand, driving them out of the churches. We see also in the statistics that every scandal in the Catholic Church was related to a lot of exits from the church. So with every scandal, more and more were leaving the church.
That's part of the picture. But since the 1970s, there have been waves of immigration from Turkey and Northern Africa, and in the past decade also from the east and southeast of Europe. Anne Goujon is leader of the Human Capital Data Lab at the Wittgenstein Center in Vienna. She's looking at the past, present, and future of Vienna's religious landscape and finding some tension associated with these changes.
I would say that the topic of religion in Austria is actually raising a lot of questions and a lot of debates, not always in the right way as we see. I mean, it's very hard to open a newspaper in Austria and not see something about the topic of religion, be it mostly about the place of Islam in the Austrian society. And so I think what we see in Vienna and in Austria is not very different from what we see across all European countries.
Another big driver of change in the religious landscape is the rapid increase in the number of people with no religious affiliation.
Within Europe, we have clearly a trend towards more secularization. This is led mostly by people having more individual sense of religion, so not adhering to a religious denomination as such, but having a belief in themselves. And therefore, we have an increased trend towards secularization.
No sign of secularization here. This is a special prayer service at a mosque on the banks of the Danube River in Vienna. The faithful are being called to show their opposition to radical Islam and the Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria. Hundreds pour into the compound, spilling out of the mosque into marquees and meadows. It's in stark contrast to the scene in many of the city's churches, where empty pews are the norm.
Once, as I came to Austria in 1986, we were accused that time. We are hiding ourselves in the cellar and under the ground. What are they doing there?
Tarafa Bagajati is the chairman of the Austrian Muslim Initiative. The mosque in which we meet is the only one in Vienna with a minaret. A prominent sign proclaims its height as a rather modest 32 meters. The city doesn't ban minarets, but it rarely approves them, even though Islam will be the religion of 19% of the population by 2031. Mr. Bagajati says it's time for Muslims and their mosques to be more visible.
As an example, we have now a very beautiful Islamic cemetery in Vienna. It needed more than 30 years of negotiation till we have it. And now everybody is happy. The neighbors are happy. The people are happy. That means we should give the knowledge of the people that our visibility is not against the society. Our visibility is a part of this society.
Just a few hundred meters from St. Stephen's Cathedral, another set of bells rings out from the belfry of the 600-year-old Church of the Maltese Order. It's midday on one of the city's exclusive shopping streets. The bell reminds believers that it's time to stop worshipping Mammon and come to prayer. Despite the noisy reminder, only two people turn up. Inside the church, I'm meeting Eitan Reif, spokesman for an organization called Religion is a Private Matter, which campaigns for separation of church and state and an end to religious discrimination. With demographers forecasting that the number of people with no religious affiliation will soon be in the majority, Eitan Reif says it's time to change some laws.
Actually, privilege one group means the discrimination of another group. This is the wrong way. The better way to do it is just to try and define laws that will apply to everyone and maybe remove some of the, older laws that pretty much obsolete by now.
Austria's government is considering adding several religious holidays for Muslims to a calendar heavily biased towards Catholic holidays. Eitan thinks this is still not a fair way forward.
This is something that, again, is discriminatory because we think that people belonging to other religions, or especially not being religious, should also have the opportunity of taking, I would say, at least 3 days in this case. There is no need to privilege only one group and have a lex specialis just in order to have a few more votes next time.
Vienna's Catholic Christian traditions are visible and audible just about wherever you go in the city. But changing demographics mean others are beginning to demand their place in this religious landscape. Kerry Skyring, DW, Vienna.
And that report wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks very much for joining me today. You can listen back to this show as a podcast or go to dw.de/worldinprogress for past editions. We'll be back next week, where, amongst other things, we'll be taking a look at the situation of older people around the world. Until then, on behalf of today's studio team here in Bonn, Eliane Giaducci and Jürgen Kuhn, I'm Anke Rasper saying goodbye for now.